Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The big question is if we're done with that moderation, where does the market sit in terms of its ability to respond to another shock?
USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer on the possibilities of a market shock response in 2025.
When you look around the world, think that that's why we're taking such a close look on South American production, Russian wheat production, etc. The market seems to be satisfied with where supplies are at the moment. And usually you see a confluence of forces that put another shock into the market, at least on the supply side. It takes a couple of shocks combined to set off another price spike or a big geopolitical event. Geopolitical events can work on both sides of that market, either positive or negative as well, too. But I think if we characterize the last year, it's that there weren't those big, huge shocks.
This is Agriculture Today.
The USDA's December Hogs and Pigs report places the December 1st inventory of all hogs and pigs at 75.8 million head, down 0.8% from last quarter, but up 0.5% from last year, compared to an average trade expectation of 0.2% higher.
Dr. Jason Franken is a University of Missouri livestock economist.
Market hogs mirrored the same expected and reported changes as total inventory, while the breeding herd is up just 0.1% over the prior year as expected. The main surprise is a record September to November pig crop, up more than 2% from a year ago and just above the upper end of the range of pre-report expectations, as a marginal cut in sows farrowed was more than offset by 11.92 pigs per litter, up more than 2% from last year's record for the period, continuing the upward trend in pigs per litter. While this level of productivity growth took the trade by surprise, in part because it's difficult to continually break records by large margins, further productivity growth is feasible, as Denmark is recently averaging around 15 pigs per litter.
As he breaks down the latest USDA hogs and pigs report.
For market hogs, the heaviest weight class is down only 0.5% from a year ago compared to expectations of 1% lower, while the next heaviest group is also down about 0.5% as expected, which suggests a fairly neutral price outlook near term, as much of the heaviest class has already gone to slaughter. The lightest two weight classes are each up more than 1% from last year compared to expectations of 0.7% and 0.5% higher respectively. And these greater than expected increases are a bit bearish for the midterm. Still, there are just 0.8% more hogs weighing under 180 pounds than a year ago, which will arrive at processing plants from January to March of 2025, implying similar supplies as last year for the period overall. The greater than anticipated increases in inventories of lighter weight hogs stems from the unanticipated record September to November pig crop, which also indicates bearishly higher slaughter levels for April through June. Respective slaughter levels should be similar to last year for July through September and higher for the remainder of 2025, given farrowing intentions for this winter nearly identical to actual farrowings a year ago, and those for spring at about 1.4% higher and more than expected. However, this all depends on whether current trends in pigs per litter persist. Cold stocks of pork remain well below pre-COVID-19 pandemic levels. According to the USDA Cold Storage Report, cold stocks of pork on November 30th are down 8% from the prior month and 6% from a year ago. Meanwhile, poultry stocks are down 9% from the prior month and 7% from a year ago, while beef is up 2% from the prior month but down 4% from last year.
What about demand?
The USDA pegs U.S. per capita pork consumption at 50.5 pounds per person for 2024 and forecasts the number rising to 50.9 pounds per person in 2025, still below the pre-COVID-19 level of 52.1 pounds per person in 2019. The U.S. exported 583 million pounds of pork in October, or about 1.7% more than the prior October. Mexico accounted for 38.6% of those shipments, around 4.4% lower than a year ago, reflecting the higher wholesale pork prices and a depreciating Mexican peso. Meanwhile, U.S. pork exports for the period are around 51.2% higher to China and Hong Kong, and almost 4.9% higher to Japan than a year ago. Projected pork exports are revised downward, reflecting expectations for higher hog and pork prices to persist through 2025. As such, estimated fourth quarter exports are lowered by 35 million pounds to 1.875 billion pounds, or 2.8% higher than a year ago, bringing the total for 2024 to 7.12 billion pounds, or about 4.3% above the 2023 level. Total exports for 2025 are anticipated to be about 2.9% higher.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So the Trade Act of 1930, as it has been amended multiple times since then, forms the basis for a lot of what we review.
Stephen Vaden to be nominated to be Deputy Secretary at USDA, currently at the U.S. Court of International Trade.
It allows the Commerce Department to receive petitions from American industries which believe that they are being harmed by unfair foreign competition. And if the Commerce Department investigates and determines that industries in a particular country are being subsidized by those countries' governments, it gives the Commerce Department the power to put tariffs on them, to make up for the difference in even the playing field. And so it is those final decisions, putting tariffs or not putting tariffs, on specific goods made in specific countries that form the vast majority of the work we do. And then about 30% of the work we do are customs cases, which involve classification largely. And believe it or not, there is a list called the Harmonized Tariff Schedules of the United States. It is abbreviated HTSUS. And it attempts to list by category everything that you might ever want to bring into the United States and assigns it a tax rate. And so companies will dispute with the Customs Service, you know, we think it's this category rather than this category. And it sometimes can make huge differences in tax rates. And so if they can't come to a mutual agreement on that, it comes to us for resolution. And so those are the two primary things. One of the more high profile things that our court deals with, which definitely got revivified in the Trump administration and continues in the current administration, are a couple of unique powers that were given to the President of the United States by Congress in the 50s and 60s. These are known as Section 232 and Section 301, or where you'll find them in the statute book. But they basically give the President a large grant of unilateral authority to place tariffs on countries and goods from certain countries if he believes one of two things is true. Either the importation of goods from this country is having a deleterious effect on our national security, that's Section 232, and that's the basis under which President Trump puts tariffs on steel and aluminum items from many countries around the world. And Section 301 is used if the President believes that for other reasons, the trade practices of a foreign country are having a deleterious impact on American industry. And the President can make these decisions after statutorily required investigations. And they had not been used for about 30 years when President Trump first started reusing them. The statutes have always been on the books. They just haven't been used. And under the law, we are the only court that can hear disputes when the President uses these statutes. They affected huge sectors of the economy and dramatically increased our caseload. We had more than 3,000 cases come in just challenging the tariffs that President Trump issued under Section 301. And another unique thing about these statutes, I mentioned earlier that our court statute was last rejiggered in the early 1980s. If you're a history of the federal courts, you know that was before they rejiggered the statutes in the mid-80s dealing with federal jurisdiction. What I mean by that is prior to the mid-1980s, if you as a litigant raised a constitutional claim in federal court, federal courts were required to convene a three-judge panel in order to hear it, and then you had an automatic right of appeal to the Supreme Court. And in the mid-1980s, Congress said, this is giving the Supreme Court way too much work. We're going to change this. It'll just be a single district judge, and then it'll go up in normal way that we all know now. Well, we have a separate statute that governs us, and they did not amend our statute. Now, the unique thing about it is you don't get a direct appeal to the Supreme Court, which I don't understand, given how the statutory scheme has worked previously. Instead, you get three judges from us, and then you get three more judges from the Federal Circuit. But we are required to do it. Our statute hasn't been changed, and we follow the law.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
If you look at all the counties nationwide, there's about 40% of all of the counties that have fewer than one attorney per 1,000 residents in that county.
Roger McCohen is a Washburn University tax law specialist.
National average is about four. But that shows us that we've got a problem, not just in the plains in the western part of the country, but across the country. You could go to upstate New York, for example, and there's a rural attorney shortage there, just like we face it in Kansas, for example. We have four counties in the state of Kansas that don't have a single attorney that resides in that particular county. And that story gets repeated throughout the plains and throughout the west. And so it's a real problem, but it seems to be centered primarily in the center part of the country and further west. The ability of farmers and ranchers to find competent legal counsel to help them address their unique issues is very, very difficult.
Says ag law is different.
Agricultural law, as I've said for a number of years, is basically, in many instances, law by the exception. And what I mean by that is that the Congress has legislated rules, basically back from our founding. This is something that Thomas Jefferson was very focused on, and that is that rules should be different for those that produce the food and fiber for our people. And the Congress has legislated a different set of rules, so with respect to many areas of the law, than rules that apply to non-farmers. And so we have to have attorneys that are specifically trained in those unique legal issues to properly represent farmers and ranchers. So it's not possible just to put law students that have graduated past the bar and get them into a rural area. They have to be specifically trained in those legal issues, or they could end up doing more harm than good.
But rural communities need more than just an attorney.
When you end up in a rural community, and I speak from over 30 years of experience with this, you end up being kind of a very important person in that community. You end up, in many instances, being a legal counsel for the local school board, various types of groups that are in that community. You're a figure in your local church, for example. People look up to you, and they admire you for being not only an attorney, but a counselor for them on a lot of issues. And you're kind of a big fish in a small pond, and you're not just a peg in a hole, as you can end up with being with a big firm in a large city and just kind of get lost. And there are a lot of misconceptions and misperceptions that we have to disabuse our students from. And that is that you have to go to the big city to be successful. No, you can be successful in a small town. The saying is probably heard it, you bloom where you're planted. And you can bloom pretty large in a small rural community. And the feeling of being very significant person in helping people and helping farm families see their legacies continue in their families is very rewarding. And working with farmers and ranchers is a very rewarding aspect of the practice. And I hope that our students who end up in rural communities find that out, and I'm sure that they will. If you can master tax, estate planning, business planning, real estate issues, that's going to be your bread and butter with respect to a rural practice. That's going to be particularly the tax end of things. That'll be continual business for you year after year after year. And then you fit in the other issues the clients have, such as fences and leases and water issues. And those come periodically. But your bread and butter is always going to be your tax, your estate planning, your business structures, entity creation. All of that is the core of a rural practice. And then you fit the other legal issues that your farm clients and your ranch clients have around those issues.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think on the crop side that there wasn't a big shock.
That's USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer.
We've gone through 3 or 4 years of just unusual events which have had significant impact on the agricultural sector. We look over the last 4 years, you got trade friction with China, then you have pandemic issues, then you got a price run up from the war in Ukraine, and then you've got perhaps some production shocks around the world. You have some countries like India putting export controls on rice. I think the difference in this year than maybe perhaps the last several years is the absence of a really big shock into the market, which allowed those prices to moderate.
From market shocks to the Beneficial Ownership Information Report.
Farmers and ranchers may be feeling like they're on a roller coaster when it comes to beneficial ownership information reporting requirements. A previously reinstated filing requirement has once again been put on hold. Dustin Shearer, Director of Government Affairs for the American Farm Bureau Federation, says a federal court has again delayed a requirement to report information to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN.
The same circuit court, but a different panel, the merits panel, said we agree to hear this appeal, but we are vacating the stay of the injunction that was issued in the meantime in order to maintain the constitutional status quo. Once again, we are back where we were on December 3rd, which is there is no filing deadline for this information as of right now.
Shearer says farmers and ranchers may have to wait a little while longer before a permanent decision is made.
I would expect something to happen within the next month or two, but obviously that also coincides with some political changes. We have a new Congress getting sworn in January 3rd. We have a new administration getting sworn in on January 20th. I expect the incoming administration to have a different view of the Corporate Transparency Act than the current one.
He says any small business owner who may be required to file should have their paperwork in place just in case.
That is our recommendation. If you have consulted with an attorney or a CPA, or you've looked at the rules yourself and believe that you are a business owner who has a small business who is subject to these filing requirements, it is our strong recommendation that you have all this information gathered up and ready to file should the court decide to reinstate the deadline at some point in the near future.
Election 2024 is behind us, and some new faces are taking over leadership on the House and Senate Ag Committees. Sam Kiefer, Vice President of Public Policy for the American Farm Bureau Federation, says the four leaders of the committees have a wealth of experience.
The House Ag Committee chairman is Glenn G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania. He's well-established. New ranking committee member Angie Craig from Minnesota. New, but not inexperienced. On the Senate side, John Bozeman from Arkansas takes over as the committee chairman. He's been serving as a leading Republican for a while. And joining him from the other side of the aisle is Senator Amy Klobuchar from the Democrats. Again, new to her post, not new to Congress, not new to the Ag Committee.
Once the new Congress is sworn in on January 3rd, they've got to get to work right away.
They need to get back to the business of doing a farm bill. We've been kicking the can down the road for the better part of 2 years. Congress also has to deal with expiring tax provisions before the end of 2025. Not to mention there's a number of regulatory oversight opportunities for members of Congress. They also need to figure out the budget, and the current budget only goes until March.
Outside the halls of Congress, there will also be a new president in the White House.
We've been working with the Trump transition since Election Day and letting them know where farmers and ranchers are on policy issues and what their wants and needs might be. As we look to the new Congress, we've been hitting the ground for the last several months, getting ready to focus on the tax issues, continue the conversation on Farm Bill, and make sure that the regulatory oversight opportunities get some attention paid to them.
For updates on these issues and more, keep an eye on FB.org throughout 2025. Chad Smith, Washington.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I really loved my time at Patton Boggs. They were very good to me, and I seriously considered staying behind.
Tennessee farmer Stephen Vaden nominated to be Deputy Secretary at USDA. On a recent podcast talking about his time with the U.S. Court of International Trade.
But once again, in a theme that I think, if we're being honest, is with most people's lives who've had any measure of success, is a wise voice whispered in my ear. And that wise voice came to me and said, look, I know that you have concerns about whether Jones Day is the right place for you. But here's what I'm going to tell you. It may not be your forever home, but I think it's going to be the place that gets you to where you need to go. So take the leap and go there. And I'm very glad I listened to her, because that ended up being 100% true.
And so tell us that story, actually, about how you made the jump from Jones Day to the Department of Agriculture during the last administration, eventually rising to become the Senate-confirmed general counsel to that department.
Well, we represented a number of presidential candidates in the 2016 election. Of course, most famously, Donald Trump, who won, but we also represented Rick Perry, Chris Christie, Scott Walker as well. So there were four presidential candidates early in the primary process that were represented by the three partners of the Jones Day political group, and then the two associates, myself and a good friend, Annie Donaldson. We did the grunt work on them, and we're happy to do so. We had represented the Romney campaign both times he ran. Unfortunately, he didn't win, so there were no opportunities that came from that in government service. But in August of 2016, I remember it well, Don McGahn, who later became White House counsel and was President Trump's top outside counsel at the time, came to me and said, if then candidate Trump wins, think about some places you might like to serve in the government and give me a list of four or five. And I joked that August was the last time the polls looked anything approaching good before Election Day, but I gave it some thought. And I put down four or five items. I thought about it over a weekend, actually, before I returned it to him. When I did, it wasn't long before he came down to my office and he said, you put down agriculture. He's like, nobody puts down agriculture who's given this opportunity. They all want to work at the White House or, you know, somewhere. Why did you put down agriculture? And I reminded him of my background and that I knew the communities USDA served, because my community is one of them. Very familiar with the work of the department. And at that point, my father had passed away. And so I was not only helping him with the farm, it was my farm. So I was familiar with their work and it was personally meaningful to me. And you could literally see the gears turning in Don's head as I was talking. And he just said, you know, this makes perfect sense. It's like, how would you like to be general counsel of the Department of Agriculture? And I said, well, that sounds great to me. And he said, good, we'll put that down. And I really didn't give it too much more thought until, you know, he won on election night. And then Don said, you know, congratulations, you're on the landing team for USDA and you'll be there on day one running a legal shop. And, you know, I was there. He made me, through President Trump's approval, made me acting general counsel. And then in September of 2017, let's see, having just turned 35, I was nominated to be a Senate confirmed officer and the head general counsel of one of the largest cabinet agencies in all of the federal government.
Wow.
So it was kind of a confluence of opportunity, ability, and my background came together to make that the perfect role. And if you put me back to that date in 2016, knowing what I know now, and said, Stephen, I'll give you whatever position in the federal government you want, just name it, after having done what I've done, I would pick the general counsel of the Department of Agriculture all over again. When I die, I may still tell you that that's the most fun job I ever had.
The podcast, Original Jurisdiction. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
That's the temporary ag worker program that helps employers who anticipate a lack of available domestic workers.
Roger McCohen is a Washburn University tax law specialist talking about the H-2A program.
So if you have foreign workers that are brought to the U.S. to perform either temporary or seasonal ag work for such things as planting and cultivating and harvesting, then this is the program that will assist those farming operations, or at least it's designed to assist those farming operations in finding those workers. But, of course, once you are in the program, then you become subject to the rules of that program.
And a new rule has gone into effect for the H-2A program, and there are challenges.
Its stated purpose is to increase wage transparency and state when an employee can be terminated for cause and prevent employer retaliation against temporary seasonal ag workers. Plus, there are expanded safety requirements and more employer disclosure requirements and new rules for self-advocacy of workers. It's going to be more difficult for a covered employer to terminate workers because the rule has new restrictions on the employer's ability to terminate workers for cause. You've got to go through quite a labyrinth of warnings and write-ups and all those types of things before you can terminate a worker, and then there are additional rights those workers have. So it's much more detailed process for terminating workers under the program. And workers that are under the H-2A program have the right to get paid for 3/4 of the hours offered in the work contract, even if the work ends early. And also that same rule, this same rule gives them housing and transportation until the worker leaves, and payment for outbound transportation. And if the worker is a U.S. worker, they have to be contacted for employment in the next year unless they're terminated for cause. Basically, when the employer demonstrates that the worker has failed to comply with employer policies or rules or has failed to satisfactorily perform job duties after they've been issued, as I mentioned, progressive discipline, unless, as the rule says, the employee has engaged in egregious misconduct, or I should say the worker has engaged in egregious misconduct. So basically what this is saying is that the employer, the farm operation, must have pretty detailed policies or rules in place detailing what the job duties are and what the expectations are and what the discipline levels are going to be. And I think there's probably a lot of farming operations, particularly smaller ones, that don't have that established set of procedures in place. And they need to have that done under this new rule. Under the rule, vehicles that are required by the Department of Transportation regs to be manufactured with seat belts, in those vehicles, the farm employer has to retain and maintain those seat belts in good working order. And you cannot operate the vehicle unless each worker is wearing a seat belt. So that's going to be an interesting one. The enforcement of that one, I really kind of wonder about. There's a good list of information on the Department of Labor's website about what employers need to be doing to start to get ready to comply with this new rule, and that's probably a good place to go. But this is an important rule. There are a number of farming operations in Kansas, obviously, and in the plains and out west and in the south that are in the program and do utilize the program. So it's important for these farming operations to be aware of what this new rule is, because the penalties can be rather severe depending on what is violated.
There is a preliminary injunction for quite a few states. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
From an agricultural standpoint, the timing was very fortuitous because we had very little drought coverage early in the year. A lot of our major summer row crops actually made it through in reasonably good shape before the development of significant drought late summer through the autumn. And that did help us actually achieve a record U.S. corn yield in 2024, currently pegged at a little over 183 bushels per acre.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Not quite a record, but still a fairly formidable soybean crop, 51.7 bushels per acre, and a virtual tie with the 2021 record with almost 4.5 billion bushels of production for soybeans. So again, the timing on that drought was very fortuitous in terms of getting the crops through and into maturity before things got really bad. And then the autumn drought actually helped with the harvest of those crops. And so corn and soybeans came out quickly. So if you have to have a drought, that's probably the best timing you can have.